Hello and welcome to Booktopia On. I'm Bronwyn.
I'm Ben.
I'm John.
I'm Sarah.
And today we're talking about Death of the Cultural Cringe. John, what on earth does that mean? Come on, tell us.
I suppose having been selling books for 25 years or whatever it is, I've been sort of witness to this great change in book selling and publishing in Australia, where we've gone from, if it's written by an Australian, I won't buy it, to the whole of the, all the bestseller has been dominated by locally produced content across all genres and all non-fiction categories we can think of. And I think it's time to talk about, because it used to be a massive thing during the 50s and 60s and 70s that we kowtowed to Britain and Europe, or then changed our minds and started to kowtow to America.
And not just in books, in culture in
general. Culture in general. And I just think that Australia is starting to just become
into its own.
Yeah, and so that whole cringe thing is sort of dying. We don't all rush to London to get our education. We don't all rush to America to feel full and full intellectuals or in any field. We don't need to. We can stay here and become leaders in a field.
I think you've got a really interesting perspective for someone like me because, as you said, you've been in books basically for the entire time I've been alive. Does that make you feel old, John?
Oh, my God.
And I've only been in books for 2 years, so when I came into it, I feel like I've come into now in the middle of us championing all these Australian authors and Australian books and not cringing at them like you might have witnessed back in the day.
Did you see anything, Sarah? Have you seen any changes in genre, especially?
From my perspective, I feel like there's always been a lot of pride from Australians around our stories and movies and books, but there just were fewer of them. So I don't really recall a time when people were looking down on Australian stories, but just by virtue of the fact that there weren't many, and now there's much more.
I got a sense in the YA area, though, that the readers...
Oh, yeah, that's really true.
Would only read America or European writers because they were somehow closer to it, whatever it is.
Whereas
now we've got
Love Was
YA.
Yes, exactly.
But the actual fact that exists suggests that within that genre itself...
That there was a problem.
There's a problem.
There was a problem. But again, I don't know if it was ever... Like, I don't ever recall people going, oh, Australian YA novels suck.
I've heard that in this office.
Really?
Yes. I won't out anyone, but yeah.
Not from me.
No, not from you.
Yeah. I guess there weren't many, and now not only are there more, but they're being fiercely celebrated and supported, which is amazing. And I guess that is kind of death of the cultural cringe, really. Or let's call it the birth of the cultural celebration.
Do you think maybe, though, with the YA sort of growing the way it has something to do with the growth of social media as well? Because, you know, the YA community are very... involved in social media, whether it's the authors or the fans. And so now they have a platform in which to communicate their love for their book and to further the message, if you will. So.
Yeah, definitely. And we could get really kind of sort of philosophical and about the ways the world has changed and that having like the internet and the world becoming more globalized in a way gives people more incentive to identify themselves as something unique.
That's deep. I like that.
Am I making sense? Because I'm flying by the seat of my pants.
No, but, I follow what you mean.
But yeah, like whereas before, you know, let's say 30 years ago or...
To get somewhere was a lot
definitely
harder.
Like pre-internet times, people felt like Australia maybe was down at the bottom of the world.
We're so far away.
Now we just jump online and it's, you know, it's different. I think it makes us more keen to own our own culture.
To be distinguished,
I'm just staring at Ben. He's got this very official-looking
paper in his
lap. I know,
your notes are really intimidating, Ben.
It's like government.
I didn't bring any notes. I'm clutching a copy of Into the Night by Sarah Bailey. That's
all you need.
that's a valuable product right there. And that's, you know, that's an example of what we're talking about. I printed out something from the Australian Council of the Arts, which is a survey that was run a few years back on reading habits, and it tells me that 71% of Australians, I believe at the time, I think this was 2015, 71% of Australians think it's important for children to read books set in Australia and written by Australian authors. 60% believe it's important that Australian authors be published by Australian publishers. It also says we like mysteries and thrillers and biographies are on the rise, which is stuff we already sort of know. But, yeah, 70% are saying that it's important.
What's the other 30% thinking?
I know. They're ones that don't read.
Ambivalence, I guess.
Okay.
Anti.
you're cringing at that.
but I just thought it was good to bring some numbers into the room.
There is that sense also that 30% could be saying, no, I don't want to go down that path of patriotism and jingoism and Australianism and crap. I want that Australia has the opportunity to be an international thinking, open-minded kind of culture that accepts lots of different things. It doesn't have to sort of just talk about Australia this, Australia that.
But I think those things go hand in hand because the books we're talking about aren't all about Australia. They just happen to be written by Australians sometimes set in Australia.
Yeah. I mean, John's got a novel coming out and it's all set in England.
Very true. Look at that.
What a cringer.
Didn't want to send it in Sydney, did you?
No.
And then I think about our biggest exports on the book market at the moment. I'm thinking about Hannah Kent, who mm-hmm. writes about Ireland and Iceland, and I'm thinking about Heather Morris and The Tattooist of Auschwitz, which is set in Auschwitz, not Australia. And these are huge bestsellers, not here, but not just here, but in the whole international market. And this is something I wanted to bring up in this podcast. It's the fact that Australian authors are having great that's starting to dominate in the wider market around the world. You know, we're having debut authors coming through. We had Trent Dalton in the building yesterday, and he is he's selling into all these different territories off the back of a debut novel.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really amazing. I think that's really amazing, and I never really thought about the number of internationally hugely successful authors that are writing who are Australian who aren't necessarily writing about Australia, but I don't think that has lessened our celebration of them as being Australian. Yeah. Yeah, like they're I don't still, know we're always yeah. I think every country, this is true of every country, really quick to own our people who have international success.
Leanne Moriarty.
And Leanne Moriarty writes stories set in Australia.
Yeah.
And then they get adapted as to TV shows set in America.
She's officially.
I think it's awesome. I think that's something that's really cool. I just want to see more of that. Because Australia is fantastic and we're great at, and I think we're getting better and better at championing our own books. But our market as a whole, our readership is a fraction of the whole. And therefore the kind of, money and press, that can come into a new book, just out of the local market alone is going to be tied to the size of the market. Mm-hmm. But if you can sell into all these different territories at once. Nevermore is a great example of this from last year. Mm-hmm. That was a huge book in the UK and that has a reverberation effect amplifying the local market as well.
Mm. And then Graham Simpson, there's been a whole range of them that have gone out and done this. Jane Harper. When I remember years ago, one of the things that struck me early on was just how few genre novelists were cracking the Australian market. So we had, I remember the day that Jillaroo turned up by Rachel Treasure, and I'm thinking, what is this? What? And it was so Australian. I thought, this is not going to go anywhere. No one wants to read about Australia. And she conquered Germany and all these countries overseas with these books, and she became one of the Australia's consistent best-selling writers. And when I watched the careers of Di Morrissey and Judy Nunn, their attempts to smash into this market, which was big. We had Jackie Collins and Danielle Steele and all these writers, all these really popular writers, Jillie Cooper, being bought and sold in Australia and having this wonderful readership. And there were no local writers sort of being able to crack into this market. And so people like Judy Nunn and Di Morrissey, their first books came out and we all sort of stared at them going, what is this? Is this Australian content? Ooh, how interesting. And their careers just were a slow burn. They had to really earn their readership and convince Australians that yes, you could read these books and have them set in Australia and then be great, you know, great fun to read. And it was really, really slow. I would have people come into the shop and they would pick up a book. It looked like a international bestseller, pick it up and see, this is great, The Australian. And they put it back down. If it had an Australian newspaper saying it was great, they'd put the book down. Oh no, it must be an Australian book. I can't read that. So things like, writers like Michael Rowbotham, you know, for the first period of his career, I don't think many booksellers knew that he was Australian. He was set in the UK and it seemed to be coming from the UK and it was published in the UK. Great, another UK crime writer to sell, that's good because everyone's reading UK crime writers. Mm. And he kind of came under the radar and got his foothold in the Australian market that way. It was, you know, it was very difficult for Australian writers to be taken seriously and in the age of Grisham and Cornwell and the emergence of James Patterson, to be a crime writer in that and to be focused on Australia or considered Australian, so tough. And genre was the hardest one to crack. Look, we had literary greats winning Bookers and Thomas Keneally doing this and the other, and so our literature and Patrick White winning the Nobel Prize. Our literature was first accepted overseas, but our genre writers, even here at home, just couldn't get a look in.
But now it's really changed.
Now it's all yeah. Australia.
That was completely unfamiliar to me, you know, saying that, because just all the books I've been introduced to since working here, you know, incredible range. I mean, I obviously knew about the ones that you're talking about, you know, the big ones, the literary ones that, you know, you're introduced to at school and things like that. And then, but coming here has been like this whole new education for me about Australian authors. And I find now that when people, my friends and stuff, ask me for book recommendations, my instinct is to recommend Australian authors in all genres. And, you know, because I'm a heavy fantasy reader, of course, but coming here, I've read crime and literature and all these other genres that I never would have picked up, and most of them are Australian, and they're all fantastic, you know.
Well, definitely in the YA and the crime space, I think there's been a huge swing towards Australian.
Local.
Yeah.
I think perhaps in genre fiction, it's the, you know, you've got such a saturated market in, for example, UK crime, and you have an outsider in the form of Jane Harper, who introduces a completely different flavour. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, Matthew Riley did that in the thriller market in a huge way, you know, completely rewrote the way people think of thrillers.
Yeah.
And that this coming from an outside place.
And that was, again, one of those ones that in that early period. So he's the Di Morrissey, Judy Nunn, Bryce Courtney, Rachel Treasure movement allowed people like Matt Riley to be able to be taken as a chance of getting publication and a readership within the Australian market. And they took a chance with this guy who was competing with Tom Clancy and with Michael Crichton, Matt's hero, and these kind of writers who were established and dominated that area, international writers. And Matt's just sort of elbowed his way into the middle of it all. But he, you know, he did something different. He streamlined the great action thriller genre, just, you know, cut it down to its basics and just absolutely won a whole another generation of Australian males and females to reading, because he just allowed a little door to be opened and acceptance, and it was so easy to read, so much fun. I think that he helped a lot of the Australian market keep afloat in an era of the internet and the TV and great blockbuster movies, because he kept the door open for readers who were a bit reluctant, who didn't think there was much fun in books, and he sort of kept them in the market. And so they were able to sort of jump on other authors that sort of came in and, you know, were able to be, you know, considered readers, consistent readers.
Another fantastic thing in that thriller world to see is the fact that Booktopia does not sell a heck of a lot of James Patterson. But when James Patterson has his name next to Candace Fox, we sell that book.
Yeah.
And that is just awesome.
Especially when it's a book set in the Australian outback.
Mm.
I really love that series. Harriet Blue, everyone. Read it. I'm getting really emotional. I feel like I could crack out into the Australian National Anthem at any moment.
Or the Qantas.
Or maybe I am, you are, we are Australia.
Well, for a long time, when we go way back, the only way to get published was to get published in London. Like if you're an Australian writer, there was only publishing houses over there. And then we started to publish locally. But it was, there was a bit smelly on the market. Everyone wanted to be reading the UK and the American stuff. What I was talking about yesterday with Bron when I first sort of discussed this podcast was the difference between having a relationship with Australia, having a relationship with the UK and Europe, and having a relationship with America. I felt that the relationship we had with UK and Europe was very much master-student kind of relationship, and they were the ones who created this thing called culture, and we had to go to them to learn about it, and we would never catch up. They had hundreds of years on us, and we were such a baby country and would never catch up. But when after the Second World War, as the shift changed and we started to focus towards America, and America became our partner, it seemed like they were more like us. They were young, they were fresh. They were creating their own culture as they went. They were making it up as they went, and they got away with it. And so we had this kind of there's this possibility here of us actually doing what they've done and becoming. Becoming a fully fledged culture of our own. And I think that shift in, because the shift in perspective is key, because UK and Europe is, so frightening in its austerity and its traditions and all those sort of things. And for a little pipsqueak like us to take that down, it's just not going to happen. But turning our attention to the US just said, this is possible.
And so maybe in another 25 years, who knows how much stronger we'll be.
Well, the best thing about us at the moment is, the thing that people complained about through the 50s and 60s with this multiculturalism is the thing that's going to make us the strongest, because the more we take in people from other countries, the more ideas are going to be coming through, the more different perspectives are coming through. And Australia is a very free place, freer than other countries, even though it doesn't look like sometimes when you watch the news. But there are opportunities for writers of all different backgrounds to get published within the Australian market. And I think there'll be more and more variety in voices, and that will make us strong. I think that's part of the key to cultural strength. And I think that's something that England had for a while with their, and then they lost it. And America had for a while, and it seems to have swung the other way. But we're still just beginning to really see that. I mean, we've got so many different voices already published and already out there, and it's just amazing to see what's going to come next.
Mm. And the call for it and the appetite for it in YA as well, like in the YA vlogger community, the demand for diversity and own voices, stories, it's like wonderful to see and stronger than ever.
Yeah. Yeah. No, so the Australian experience, I think, is... I've always... Myself personally, I've never really been. I'm a sort of an internationalist as a mind. I don't like the idea of countries. I don't like the idea of being from somewhere and your personality being aligned to that. When I first went to Europe, I couldn't stand it. My accent gave me away everywhere I went.
And I'm like, do you have a pet kangaroo?
I just wanted to be anonymous and see what was going on. As a writer, I don't want to be pigeonholed into this is what Australians do, so you must do this, jump now. I want to be able to have freedom to wonder where I want to go, but I understand the need for it. I understand that if we lose Australian publishing to international pressures and global changes, that's a bad thing. I can feel that. Whether it's Frank Morehouse writing about Europe and not winning the Miles Franklin because it wasn't set in Australia, which is annoying. These there are things like that which rank. I mean, Hannah Kent wouldn't be eligible for the Miles Franklin, yet she has written two of the best books of the last little while. And our one major prize doesn't award people who don't write books set in Australia, which is a bit odd.
Mm. Well, I think, yeah, if, in terms of that, it's showing, it's sort of saying, oh, we're so limited if we're Australian, we only write about Australia, but that's not true. You know, we go out to the world and we experience new things, and we are also coming from other countries and then living here and choosing to live here. And so our experiences are not limited to, you know, outback Australia. I mean, they're amazing stories as well, really unique, incredible perspectives, but we have experiences that everybody else experiences as well. So if we get that diversity in where our books are set and the experiences we go through, we show the world that, you know, we may be isolated, but, you know, we are just part of...
We're international.
We're international as well, yeah.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting distinction, the Australian story by an Australian versus set in Australia. Like, surely if your book is set in Iceland but it's written by an Australian person, it's going to be written in a way that is informed by your culture and
where you're from. Well, I would like
John
to shake
says
that
no.
off. Yeah. Well, I don't think anyone who, if you were to read that translated into Polish, you'd have any clue that Hannah Kent was Australian. No,
it wouldn't come through in a way, like Australia doesn't factor into that story at all, but it is written by a person who is Australian, right? And I like to think that in a very, very broad, like high-level way, Australians have things that they do in their storytelling, just like Americans do. And John hates this idea. I can see it in his face. But I think it's like, look, you know, I mean, I think it would be remiss if we didn't. We spoke about genre, but we didn't really speak about fantasy. And I was thinking about it, and Bronwyn, you might be able to help me. All the big Australian fantasy authors that I can think of that I loved growing up, you know, were Garth Nix and Isabel Carmody. Yeah. And, you know, has Australian fantasy just always been strong? Has that been an area where we've always been strong, or is that my viewpoint?
It feels like that to me as well. I mean, there's always, fantasy seems to have always been there for me and as well. And there's just more incredible authors now, like, you know, J. Christoph, Amy Kaufman, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But I don't know.
No. To my,
hasn't
my experience,
been strong?
No. As I said earlier,
the genre, is there an Australian George R. R. Martin?
People weren't reading Garth Nix here. I mean, Garth Nix made the millions over in the US. Like, yeah, it's a cultural cringe thing. This is, oh no, he can't be as good as these guys because he's Australian.
I don't even think I knew Garth Nix was Australian when I was young.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Yeah.
So,
that's the attempt to try and, you know, to make sure you actually got a foothold somewhere.
Right.
You kind of had to hide. And it's not the author. I don't think the author's going, I want to hide my Australianism. I think it's more, how do we market this thing so that Australians will pick it up? Because they're not doing that in the bookshops during the 80s and the 90s and the early 2000s. They're not doing it. So how do we get them to pick it up? You know, we just hide everything that marks it out as an Australian book. But now, you know, you look at Christmas bestsellers and it's all Australian.
Trudy Canavan and, like... Mm-hmm.
Well, Kate Forsyth did.
Yeah.
I mean,
absolutely.
Everyone sort of it was definitely there. When you're talking about volumes and those kind of things, a lot of them are actually
better known
overseas. Yeah. And their incomes were coming from overseas.
And what about kids' books? Did you see the same pattern over the years as well?
Look, we had like a pretty good start with kids' books with
Possum Magic.
Yeah, yeah. Well, no, I'm talking Blinky Bill and Magic Pudding and Seven Little Australians and all there was a whole range of it. And
so this is the area where we were always.
Yeah, it looks
and
like.
Why do we think that? Is it, you know, why kids' books?
Maybe we recognise always that little kids do need
something familiar.
Stories.
Yeah,
I think there's such wonder, you know, within the difference of Australian. Wildlife and like
culture. I mean, you look at the kids' books from back in the day, like the Possum Magics and all that, and how Australian those books are with the gum trees and the animals. They are just so iconic.
Oh, yeah. little bums everywhere.
Yeah. and so maybe because for kids, we want to teach them about the country that they're living in and give them you know, pride for Australia. That's maybe why the kids' books were a bit stronger, because there was that demand for it, or that
parents always want their kids to have a magical childhood and to see magic and wonder all around
especially
them.
Yeah, actually around them. Yeah,
they would have had great competition from the UK with all the the Enid Blytons, and there's a whole range of things that would have been flooding the market from the UK. I mean, Peter Pan, your fave, would have been, you know, all these different iterations of stories told from afar. Yeah. All the nursery rhymes that had nothing to do with us, and the fairy tales that nothing to do with us, they all sort of come out of the forests of Germany and stuff. I think there would have been an imbalance even then.
Yeah.
The Australian stuff would have been there, but when you looked at the flood of other people's visions of childhood would have been coming over the border and on boats.
And see what's happening now is that, I mean, it was still strong, if not stronger than ever, with the kids, Australian kids' books, because people like Aaron Blaby, whose books have been made into films in America, you know, that...
He's one of those examples of an internationalist, you know, because he's not writing for directly an Australian audience. He's got in mind, what is a universal child? What's that universal child like, especially in this global world? And, you know, his bad guys have references to movies from all over the world.
Well, didn't he say that when he was doing his American tour that the adults change, but the kids are the same everywhere?
Yeah, that's what he's saying. Yeah. Yeah.
But I would argue, like, that there's an Australian-ness to his sense of humour.
Yeah, well,
there is.
Well, there is.
And it's kind of why...
And it translates well
perhaps, perhaps why he's had this rocket to success.
Yeah.
Because there's nothing like Aaron Blaby. It's, you know, American and the UK market for children's, particularly young children's early childhood literature, is very...
conservative.
Proper, yes. And Aaron Blaby is not, well, you know, Pig and the bad guys.
I remember years ago, a customer came in and was telling me about she bought Maurice Gleitzman's Bum Face for a niece and sent it to the US, and the grandmother over there sent it back.
Oh, wow.
Because it had Bum Face on the front.
Too
rude. Yeah, and yet the moral of that story is gorgeous, and if they'd bloody well read it,
Kid probably would have loved it, yeah.
But it was just, this ties into what I was saying before, John, that you hate so much, is that we can be international storytellers, but there's going to be like a grain of Australianness in a story by an Australian that I think you can appreciate overseas. It can be appreciated overseas because it's different.
Yeah, well, there's a bravery, I'd say. So our culture is a little bit open on those. There's evidence within the US. A lot of the references that Aaron makes within Bad Guys are from films. It's just they don't think it's Australian, because it's not from Australia.
But part of being an Australian now is you can't be an Australian person and never have seen an American film. Like,
it's no, I'm not saying that. I'm just saying the references he's making are generally kept to the adult world in the US. Yeah. We just break it and give it to the kids, and that's that little bit that's different. From us in the UK, it's not a problem. So we've kind of shared that relationship with a little bit of freedom when dealing with kids. We've got Roald Dahl, you know, is UK, and David Williams is UK, and we share that spirit with being a little bit outrageous with the kids.
Yeah. I wonder who was the first person to write for kids within jokes for adults.
I feel like it was Liz there, surely.
Oh, let's research that at some point.
The really crass ones, maybe, yeah.
So how do we... What's our... what's our conclusion on
what have this? We decided?
Do we need a new literary prize that champions all Australian work? Or do we need an international literary prize? You know, Dublin has the Dublin International Literary Award.
Oh, let's have one of those.
To open up our sort of cultural mind a bit in that direction. You know, The Miles, you know, I guess had that restriction to an Australian content as a way of, you know, railing against the cultural cringe.
Yeah.
But now if we've killed it, as we're saying. What do we need to kill next?
Let's keep
this
murder spree going.
Then,
but we have another one.
Yeah, I'd like. You know what I want to see? I want to see a genre like it's all these literary prizes, and these people who actually uphold the whole market with their sales and their acclaim by all these people buying them and reading and loving them never get a goddamn award. I mean, I want to see Kate Forsyth getting an award. I want to see Di Morrissey getting an award.
Leon
like
Moriarty.
That's what we need. Award. Like, and these. The ABIAs, Booksellers Awards, the Book Industry Awards, those are the closest I'm getting to, and we need to either support those and get those up higher and higher and higher and maybe open them up to to even more genres and different mm-hmm. books. But they're the ones that are at the moment standing out and awarding people who are really doing extraordinarily well and reaching the most readers and entertaining the most people. And that we need to sort of support that and celebrate that we can do all those sort of things.
We can write genre.
Yeah, we can write genre. We can write best-selling cookbooks. We don't have to worry about the French. You know, we can do all these things. We can do memoirs that entertain us and don't leave that are centered here in Australia. We can do anything we want to do. We're conquering each category one by one.
And we finally got to a place where Australians seem to be like really loving that.
Yeah,
and they're not going to cringe anymore.
Yeah, they're buying it in droves. I mean, the reaction to Boyce Swallow's Universe is and Holly Ringland in the last couple of months.
Lost Flowers of Outside.
Yeah, and this is fantastic. And then people like Sarah Bailey and there's a whole range of young.
And we're looking down the barrel of Christmas, and it's Jane Harper, it's Matthew Riley, Hedy McKinnon, and
Leanne Moriarty, Marcus Zusak's back. The Christmas is going to be dominated by the biggest Australian authors who are, I mean, Sarah Wilson will be back. There's a whole range of authors who are killing it.
This is where we are. I am. You are.
Stop singing. I want to go
on that note, I love it. Well, thanks for joining us, everyone, and we'll catch you next Wednesday at 11 a.m.
Thanks for listening to the Booktopia podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to us on SoundCloud and iTunes. And if your eyeballs need a workout, check us out on YouTube at Booktopia TV. And don't forget, for all books featured on this episode and all episodes of the Booktopia podcast, head to Booktopia, Australia's local bookstore, at www.booktopia.com.au. Thanks for listening.